Mate, you got a new haircut.
Got a new do. Yeah.
Who does your hair?
Well, I haven't really paid, you know, in this COVID times, I haven't really paid for a haircut for, you know, a couple of years.
But you couldn't get a haircut in COVID.
Well, you could, but I just preferred a nine-year-old.
You couldn't get a haircut. That was banned.
No. Yeah, a nine-year-old's blade and a nine-year-old's sort of vision.
There was a lady in Thurl who was doing COVID cuts. You could have gone, yeah, you could. You had to sort of message a friend of a friend.
Really?
She would then verify whether you could come into the house. And
well, we won't get her in trouble on this podcast. But yeah, no, look, my nine-year-old, he's just got an eye for those things.
He really doesn't?
He does. Yeah, he does one side. I mean, you know, Renata sort of fix up, you know, a few spots he may miss. But I mean, really, it's his look, it's his aesthetic that he's going for. And good topic, because speaking of heads of hair.
Mate, Tim Ross. One of the best I've ever seen. And a great beard.
And facial hair, yeah.
I've known Tim, I wouldn't know the actual time. It'd be 15 to 18 years known him now. And I don't know if you know this, but in a past life, I used to own a clothing label called Box Fresh.
You've told me about it, but in bits, and I feel it's drunken talk, but it's real?
It's real. It was the disaster of a business. I mean, I was very young when I started that. We did amazing things. Like, that was a $5 million business back then. But anyway, I met Tim during that journey, and he came in. He was off to New York with Merrick to do a show in New York and needed a big fluffy coat, and we were selling big fluffy coats. And
really? Oh, that was the big fluffy coat, Tom.
Yeah, when you're a celebrity in the sort of early 2000s, you could just walk in and just grab whatever you wanted. And
without a wallet, yeah.
Yeah, and Ross and Merrick just came in and just grabbed a bunch of jackets, and I think they took samples. So so that sample was sort of dead for the season. I don't think we got a chance to sell it in. But
what happened to that fluffy thing? Yeah.
Yeah, got. Yeah, well, welcome to the show, mate.
It's fabulous to be on your podcast, gentlemen. And, you know, it's a real absolute pleasure.
No doubt.
To be joining you from a motel in Bellingen, which sounds like I'm just about to do something really seedy and unsavory. But it's a Monday night and I'm on back-to-back calls, actually. I don't want to say anything too much about what I was doing before this call, but I was on a parent-teacher call with the school.
Hectic. Really? Yeah. What time was that? It's a late one.
7:30, then it was 7:30, and then 8:30. Had a little time just to get myself freshen up. You know, back-to-back meetings. What we do.
This is the big one.
Yeah, it is. And what was the upshot of the calls? Happy parent.
Oh yeah, it was all in parent teacher discussion type stuff. You know, and it was all very positive, and people had lovely things to say about the teachers and all that stuff. It was I stopped listening, to be honest.
But that is a different thing, isn't it, these days with the kid on the line? Like, I remember when my father used to go along to that night. It was a scary night. You'd be at home. You'd waiting for the results. And now the kids are involved.
Was it always a night, though? Wasn't it just during the day? You'd go to school during the day?
No, it was a night. I remember a night. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever done
that. Yeah, you go in that. You have to sit in the small little chairs.
Yeah.
You sort of know that they're sort of filling a lot of the time, depending on the school, but they're sort of filling time. They tell you what they think you want to hear.
I've been to one in my life. And it was...
No, that shows that you care, mate, that you bothered to go to white.
With an 18-year-old, and a bunch of kids in their teens. Yeah, you've been to one.
It's pretty poor, isn't it? I'm a bit embarrassed about that.
It's not great.
Do you get free motels these days, mate, after the book?
After a motel book? No, I don't.
Have you read
this one? I might occasionally get the odd free room from time to time from someone, but certainly not tonight. Paying $165 for this joint.
Yep. I don't think you're like a food critic coming along to a restaurant going, oh, he's here. He's here to write about us.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, I would normally criticise, this is a 1970s motel that's been renovated, and I quite like my motels when they're original, but to be honest, the renovation's quite nice. With a little glass of Petaluma Chardonnay, I'm very happy.
Nice. What are you drinking, Luke? What do you got?
Yeah, no. Well, I was having a seltzer just before you arrived, but then you came with the Pinot Noir. So we've I'm swapping. I'm just sipping one and drinking the other. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Question of the day.
There was one that got me the other day, and it was: is our brain really cut out for the modern world? That was So I thought we'd start with something easy for you.
That's your answer.
Yeah. It's a grunt. It's all about in the old days, the brain would just sort of like work around, you know, things you had to do. You hunt, you eat, you know, you look after your family. And now you've got to rationalize all this information coming at you.
Hunt and you eat.
Well, yeah, I'm going back to caveman times. And now you've got to rationalize in the brain, you know, so it was sort of feel first, think second. So now is there sort of like a tough thing sort of like going on that, you know, can't really be worked out by a Facebook algorithm? I mean, what is the brain doing?
I mean, it's sort of interesting, and we think that there's certain that this is the first time our brains have had to change and have to deal with information in different ways. But say we've done it before. So the advent of the modern novel or book, you know, that we read is only 150, 200 years old. You know, people didn't have books. And so our brains weren't used to sitting down and reading a book. There's a huge change for human beings. You know, we go back to, like you were saying, Luke, back in the day, you know, what do? You know, kill a woolly mammoth, you know, root your missus, draw something on a wall, try not to get stabbed. There was no time to sit around and, you know, draw, you know, 5 hours reading some sort of, you know, Malcolm Gladwell book or something. So we had to learn to sit down and read a book for 5 hours straight. Completely new thing, and only reasonably recently. And then by the same token, our brains now are rewiring to deal with to multitask in different ways. And so we forget how to to be in that way. And we're all the same. And I think we'd all be lying if we couldn't sit somewhere and go, I'm just going to watch this show on TV without checking our phone and then flicking from Instagram to Facebook to Twitter to LinkedIn to emails, the whole lot. So we're constantly pushing our brains around. But is that right for us? Only time will tell, but we're pretty, if we couldn't adapt or didn't enjoy it, we wouldn't do it. So I think there's a bizarre evolution going on that we're, I suppose, are we ready to cope with the modern world? Have we ever been able to cope with any of our realities?
I mean, he's spot on. It's like you've read the article, my friend. Like, that's basically what it was saying, was that we will evolve. It was like this sort of panic question of like, are we in trouble here? But then it went on to say, we've done this throughout the ages, you know. I mean, even though now we've gone to this stage where it seems that feelings carry more weight, and that gut instinct, even when it comes to sort of like, I guess it's the, you know, COVID being, you know, the perfect example of people doing their own research, which means you sort of Google a bunch of articles and then sit in the rabbit hole that it takes you down on the toilet while you go, I've got a gut instinct that it's not for me.
Yeah, it's amazing how many of these conversations go back to that, back to data and back to information and back to social media.
I mean, the thing about the idea of the fear of the virus, it's probably not, given that there's mechanisms in place to stop you from getting it, in all different versions of it, whether or not it's just simply not leaving your house if you want to, putting on a mask, not kissing your Uber driver, choosing any of the potential for us to get crook is far less scary than, you know, when you know those movies where someone's in a village and then, you know, a marauding tribe come and steal your children and kill you, you know,
that is terrifying.
That is terrifying. I mean, and that's, say, look at it, that was happening, same thing, it was happening 150 years ago. In some places it's still happening.
You know, so with this information, you know, you talk about reading a book, and, you know, I've read all of Malcolm Gladwell's books, and I would have gladly gone out to the world and professed all that as my own information. You know, I'm a lot smarter now as a result of reading those books. At least I thought I was. And it's happening now, like in a very micro sort of sense, that we're picking up a phone, you ask me a question, I can give you the answer really quickly, but I don't actually know if the answer's right or wrong, but I'm happy to share it because I just read it.
Yeah.
You know? So we're almost losing that intellectual humility, sort of disappearing.
My point was about trivia night, Tim. I mean, it's got to be suffering when you've just got phones under tables and stuff.
Yeah. But then again, you know, people always cheated at trivia. I mean, we know a lot more about a lot of things, but I also think we forget more than ever before. So, you know, I was watching like some new series 2 of some show on Netflix. And I reckon it was probably maybe it might have been 2 years ago I watched series 1.
Right.
And I watched far more television than I ever did before.
Oh.
And so
good and bad.
Good and bad. Yep. And like, for life of me, I could not fucking remember what happened on that show.
Yeah.
And it was like, I watched the whole thing. Whereas when I was 15, I would have remembered everything. And sure, you know, booze, you know, becomes a part of that. But I've watched more television in 2 years than I would have watched in the rest of my life combined.
Yeah.
And so as a result, yeah, you're richer for it. But also it's disposable. Oh.
And not having to wait for anything too. I mean, without it, but, you know, this turning into a 40-something sort of, you know, things were better back then. But, I mean, just the amount of stuff you get, and then your kids can get, and then they just stop after 5 minutes. Nothing's really given a chance anymore, you know. And as a filmmaker, Now, when I go along, you know, for pitches, they're like, they're looking at the first 4 or 5 minutes. They're looking, that pilot episode had better be good. And there's some great shows that had crappy pilots that you've got to just stay with. You know, I mean, you're not given the chance now. It's like the first single on an album. It's like, nah, no good, next.
If I decide to both of you go, you know, what are the top five TV shows you've watched this year? You're probably remembering them. Probably, maybe it's just because I'm a pisshead, but no, maybe remember. Maybe
I say that to you all the time.
I just thought Breaking Bad.
Yeah, but you're going back to the early noughties or the late 90s. Seinfeld?
Yeah.
you're clutching it because there's great stuff in all of them, and then you watch a bit of this and, you know, they've got seven running at once.
You know, like it is when you go back and have a look at things. Like the other day, we're going, I've got to watch something for the kids. And there's not a lot of films around.
We were saying sorry to cut you off, Tim, and I'll finish that, but like my kids watched Goonies for the first time and they were like, why don't we make films? Like, where are those?
Yeah.
Where
did
are those
they say 80s that or did you say that?
I think I might have said that. They sort of said, that's okay. Can we just watch the fucking, you're dead right. The Karate Kid fell on deaf ears. They went, well, they prefer Cobra Kai. And I'm like, oh, nah, the Karate, you're missing the point.
But I got them and I went, you know, and you forget what the content is. And so like, I go, oh, Teen Wolf, that'd be great. You know, Michael J. Fox,
yeah.
Just you know, plays basketball as a werewolf and wins and shit. You know, like the kids are going to love that stuff. But it's a teen movie. And they're trying to get booze.
That's
and then
right.
Michael J. Fox.
The girl takes the top off and, yeah.
Yeah, and I wouldn't get to that bit, unfortunately, but they're like, you know, they're getting in a cupboard and they're making out and stuff. And my kids are 10 and 7. I'm like, oh. And then I thought, okay, let's go something safe. And so I thought, oh, Mrs. Doubtfire. I'd actually never seen it, but the premise of it, I went, yeah. Oh, you know, like.
That's fun. Yep.
He dresses up as a woman so he could see his kids. But the start of it's incredibly sad, you know, and we're watching this in lockdown where, you know, let's all be honest here, parents can have a few Barneys in a lockdown situation. 100%. And so my kids have seen a bit of that going on. And then so it starts with this fight between Robin Williams and Sally Field.
Yeah.
And so they're fighting and then, you know, it's all and they Sally Field turns around and goes, we're getting a divorce. And I'm there with my youngest. And he just looks at me and says, Dad, what's a divorce? And I'm like, oh, we can't watch this anymore. Yeah, this is I know he's putting on a fat suit and stuff and wearing fake boobs. But you know,
do you class yourself as a comedian? If someone says,
I'm still bringing the fucking funny, man.
Like, you know, I want to dig into that a bit.
And
you are funny. I must admit, I've seen a bunch of your shows lately and you still bring me to the floor every time. Just through storytelling.
No, I suppose I don't do traditional stand-up in clubs or shows as I, you know, probably used to do. Or sorry, just still declining a phone call. So I don't do the same style of comedies I used to do. But yeah, I mean, I can't not tell stories that might have some sort of joke. I mean, I can be fucking really boring and earnest at the best of times. And it gets worse the older you get. But you know, people still I think come along to see what I do and expect a degree of humour. So yeah, the answer is yeah, that I like rolling around in our own stories and nostalgia plays a big part of
it. And there's no reason you can't do something else. I mean, the funny thing when we had this selection of guests to come on, Tim, like I was like, I want to talk that sort of sea change that you've done. It's like, I was remembering that Robin Williams line when he won the Oscar and, you know, his father always said, oh, you may not make it, have a backup career like welding. And it's like, it's almost like your design and architecture work. And as Ben's saying, it was always in you. Was there I just find in my profession, if I direct comedy commercials for a while and then I go into a horror film, you know, like, which is what I did, people are like, what's going on? I thought you were the comedy guy. Did you find like, was that an easy step? I know you probably answered that question a lot, but it's sort of like, was it sort of just a natural progression for you to sort of do what you're doing now?
Is that like podcasting as your backup? Is that similar to this?
Very much like that.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of answers to this is that I was lucky I did it like in this time, you know, it's probably 8-9 years ago, I suppose now, you know, when we social media came along and allowed you to change streams a little easier. It also gave the general public a bit of an insight into, they'd find out more about people that I suppose they had profile. And so it's a simple, I remember thinking, you know, that when Twitter came along, I'd see people that are on, you know, you're a news reader on ABC would be conversing on Twitter with a gossip writer from Channel 7 or something like that. And you realize that there were, that people just didn't necessarily sit in the same pigeonholes all the time. And people would share other ideas about things that they were passionate about. And so I suppose I'd always talked a lot about my interest in architecture and design. And when I was doing commercial radio, it was always a fodder of jokes that I was, you know, I'd go somewhere and I'd be collecting furniture or something, you know, which is fair enough too. You know, and I'm just a strange cat. I've got really interest. I've got weird takes. So it's just that just came along and it just expanded. And I just sort of went, you know, what do I want to do? And I was, when I was still doing radio show, I met this guy who had a rug shop in Bangalore, my mate Milton. And he spent his life traveling the world, meeting incredibly interesting people and buying rugs and seeing parts of the world that you would never see, you know. And he was the happiest guy in the world. And you'd go in there and chat and, you know, you'd go, you want to buy a rug? You'd go, yeah. And then he said, don't worry about it. Take it home with you. If you want it, bring me up with your credit card. If you don't want it, send it back, you know. And and just completely, you know, happy for you to do that. And I remember walking away, you know, having these chats with him because I'd go in there a bit, just shoot shit. I'd just go, I want to be that guy. I want that. I have this idea that, you know how guys that, there's this thing, oh, you need a man cave, you need to go into, everyone wants a shed, you know, men need a shed to retreat into. I don't need that. I don't subscribe to that.
Any for me,
I don't have a shed.
The world's my shed. I want to go and do things and experience things. That's what makes me happy. So it's, and then the general public are really amazing because, you know, Instagram, I managed to be able to create a new audience rather than take an old audience on a different ride. So that's probably the trick. I'd be very surprised. And I always am when there are people that might have listened to me for 10 years on commercial radio will turn up to an architecture talk that I do.
Does that happen?
Well, not as much as I would. I don't think so. But I'm sure there are people who might have listened to me from time to time. But those sort of, some of them would just go, he's gone a bit weird or whatever. Or they liked what I used to do with Merrick, and which was a great act. And so I haven't asked anything of them. I've actually sort of start again, which for most people is sort of terrifying. But because I didn't want to do half an act, no disrespect to Merrick and what we used to do. But that was my role in that was very specific and it only worked in that. And so I had to learn, I just chucked out all that old gear and I started again. And I learned, you know, whereas most of my peers had that 15, 20 years head start on their own acts. But I just had to really just start again. And that was difficult. That I found that really challenging, but it was really good for
me. How do you do that when you're in that space and you've got, because I've gone through a similar thing with business, you know, but this is, it's not me. It's not my persona and my personality and my life that's standing in front of people. So how do you transition through that?
Well, you just do it because you have to, because otherwise you don't have a career. So it's, and you just trial and error, you know, and you just get up and you do it.
Do you think family makes a difference? Do you think having kids is a different motivation than it was when you didn't have that? You can go out and just shoot from the hip.
No, I think kids make you better human. I think that's true. No, and I think I was just encouraged by that. I was doing these little shows and you just meet interesting people all the time. And, you know, when I was doing the radio, I met everyone but met no one. And then now, you know, I meet people and then, you know, it's sort of, oh, wow. You become friends with them or connect with them rather than, you know, someone comes in and you talk to them on air for 10 seconds and then, you know, you go, oh, I met that person once, but you don't. And yeah, it's like anything. And it's sometimes it was tricky, you know, certain people in the media just go, oh, we just like TV people would go, we just see him as
that. We know you
person.
As that. Yeah, yeah, you're that guy.
And we can't deal with the fact that, you know, and whereas, you know, in the UK, you know, they got this rich tradition of comedians fronting documentaries and talking
absolutely.
About things.
Like, Tony Robinson. Yeah, there's a whole bunch that just go on and do interesting stuff. Look at Stephen Fry. Yeah. I mean, the guy goes around and writes, you know, books for musicals and then, you know, host QI and then, you know, it's got some of the funniest stuff I've ever seen, you know?
Yeah. I love the transition, mate, by the way.
To be fair, he's genius.
It helps. Yeah. Whereas Parkinson said he's got the brain the size of Kent, you know?
So when you're at the stage and you go, I need to let go of that to sort of start this new journey, who do you talk to about that?
A lot of it was very much internal and, you know, my best mate, Kit, who I perform with, you know, he was a big part of that. But I just, you know, there's always people come into your life who say yes. And, you know, I had a few people like that that would just, and if they hadn't said yes to me, I wouldn't have been able to do some of these things. And I found, and then more people were saying yes. So that's why, you know, I like to say yes as much as I possibly can.
For sure. What you're still doing, you're still performing, you're still, you know, I mean, it's even like as a filmmaker, you can do genres of films and it shouldn't be defined by, oh, wow, you're stepping out of comedy and doing, you know, thriller. Can you do it? You know, it's like, I don't know, storytelling.
It's all the same, isn't it?
I'd like to think we're a bit more than just, you know, oh, you do the gags.
The comedy guy, the thriller guy.
Yeah, I don't know. It's
But I think what's really interesting about that is that I think we're in, and if anyone's listening to this and feels pigeonholed, I suppose the advice about that is that you are in charge of that.
Yeah.
If you believe that you can do it and you want to change whatever you do, you are actually the person that, I don't want to get all, you know, yeah, motivational speaker on this, but it is true, is that when you believe in it and you want to do that, and it's, if people don't get it, well, that's their problem, really.
Yeah. Yep.
But they will get it if you believe it.
Were you like a life, oh, this is, once you broke into radio and then it was like you just took off and then it was sort of, this is us now forever. This is me. Well, this is me forever. Or did you say, no, this is a part of the journey. This is a step.
I suppose when I started performing, I probably, you know, my dream was to do, you know, sketch comedy or, you know, comedy on TV. And I probably, especially even when Mez and I started, we didn't really imagine that most of our work would be on radio. We sort of fell into it.
Yeah, right.
And then that became most of our career. So with some TV thrown into it, but that's probably what I thought once the comedy thing was working where it would be. But no, I don't, I suppose a different way of looking at it is part of me would think if 23-year-old me saw what I was doing now, I think they quite like it.
Yeah.
I think it quite makes sense to them. And I don't think they would be surprised in some ways. Whereas maybe 30-year-old me maybe would be surprised and could be potentially disappointed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is an element.
Jeez, we could unpack that.
Well, you only start writing your memoirs and your book when you get to where, you know, like there's a sense. Sense of grown up. Well, yeah, totally.
Are we writing a fourth? Is that you talking about?
You've got to have experience to get
book.
There.
I've got a new book of short stories coming out for Christmas, yeah.
Prolific.
Yeah.
They're very good. Nothing on.
Yeah, nothing on COVID.
So did that have an impact on you? So when, you know, I know with me personally, COVID was a disaster for me. And I think the first iteration when COVID rolled around, I was incredibly optimistic, and this is where optimism can bite you on the ass. You
know? The first one was romantic. Last year, we were saying that it was kind of romantic.
Well, it wasn't for me. It was a disaster. The second one, I didn't mind because I was prepared. Well, you know, because what happened in the first one? Yeah, it's reversed for me because the first one just hit us like, you know, it happened. And I was like, all my clients, take a chill pill. You can just take some time out and don't pay us for a while. And, you know, and that never came back. And I sat there for 6 months just sort of waiting and hoping, you know, that the world would just go back to normal and my business would go back to normal. And what I realized really quickly was that this is sort of on me. You know, I needed to go and redesign my business to solve problems because the problems in the world were different to what they were pre-COVID.
Yeah.
You know, the use of technology had changed, the way people use screens had changed, and the reliance on social media had changed. And so the you know, sitting back and waiting, this wasn't the decline in my business in that period wasn't COVID's fault, it was mine from sitting there waiting and hoping, you know, and that's part of the problem, right?
Well, I think there was sometimes the sitting and waiting was the clever move too, because you could, you know, everyone talked about pivoting and, you know, people put too much effort into pivoting and then everything went back to normal. Mm. And, you know, I found the energy to keep a business running in the entertainment industry in that time, just that was like 5 years in one. And then in the more recent Sydney lockdown that affected me, you know, like it was tricky because it wasn't nationwide and everyone was prepared to wait. And so there wasn't the same opportunities to solve problems for people. It's quite most of the work that we did that was digital in that first year of COVID, it was about, I just identified where people would need certain things and we got a bit of work out of that. But people didn't feel the same in certainly in Sydney, because you could get stuff made in Melbourne or you could get it done in Brisbane or whatever. So they just sort of waited and predominantly a year of live work, which makes things really tough. But so, yeah, you sort of either cry about it or I just thought, oh, look, what, I'll just do some writing and do some other things. And, you know, you try and make it up on the other side. But it's hard, I reckon. It's like when you know, some industries are so kissed on the dick, like construction.
Yeah.
They're the things that made me angry, you know. This is just, and they'd have the biggest cry about having to stop work for two weeks. And you know, and just so tone deaf. And they've made a mozzer over the last 2 years. And then,
yeah.
And I think that's highlighted the real sadness of the way that the federal government views the arts. It's awful.
Yeah, it's devastating.
That's a whole new podcast in itself, all these different rules and regulations and the ones that make sense and the ones that don't. And
well, when there, didn't I?
Threaten the COVID. It's, you can't, yeah, that's, it, I, when you have discussions now with people, I think it's the best to say, let's not talk about it. You know? Yeah.
Hey, talk about your big question. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, you brought it up. Let's move on.
Yeah. I know I did. Yeah.
What about the big question you asked earlier and you talked about forgetting shit. We just forget shit all the time. Yeah. What about technology? So today I get in my car and I've got to go, I'm going to see my mate who, you know, amazingly did a beautiful video for Dave Winner, who's got a broken back and he's in a spinal ward. So Prince, what is it called?
Prince of Wales. Prince and you went Wales. To RPA.
So I get in the car, I tell Google Prince of Albert Hotel.
Prince of Albert Hotel. That's
Prince of Albert Hospital, whatever it's called. Royal Albert. What's it called?
Royal Prince Alfred. Yeah, in Newtown. Yeah,
actually, you know the Royal Albert. I think me and you have had a few beers in there.
Yeah, that's in,
we have.
Surrey Hills. Yeah.
Surrey Hills.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But so I get into the car, tell the car to go to the Prince
RPA.
RPA, Prince of Wales in Randwick. I'm going to Camperdown. And at no point during that 50-minute drive did I even click or think for myself that I'm going in the wrong area. On the phone chatting to people.
Because you've done that when you've turned up to the wrong, gone to the wrong house, one of my shows.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't think it's got anything to do with technology, mate. You just,
that was
technology. Just face get it.
Could be. Yeah. It was the same fucking issue.
You know, and rather than going to Bondi, wherever it was, you went to the Upper North Shore.
Yeah, but the worst part about that was we had friends driving. Me and Nick were in the back drinking wine.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get the defense though on how is it technology? So are you saying without technology, you would have written it down on a piece of paper? Is that?
Well, yeah. Difference? I don't know. I would have thought I probably would have used my brain instead of sitting there going, the computer says no.
No, you wouldn't have. You would have done exactly the same thing.
Probably.
But you do it with a smile. You even rang me after spending an hour and you still laugh about it. I don't know if you're cursing, but you're still sort of
like, no, because you do. You're like, great like that. You laugh at your own.
You just do laugh at it. I go, I just wasted 2 hours of my life going across Sydney, like, you know, 4 days after lockdown's been released.
Like there's things I get angry about, but it's not getting lost or making. Maybe that's my problem.
You're emotionally involved, mate. You're very evolved.
I need to get a bit more emotional about that stuff. Really put my foot down.
It's the Power Five.
Soundtrack to your life.
A couple of tracks, yeah, or an album or something.
The band Last Waltz.
There you go. Good.
Came the band away. The Last Waltz.
Yeah. Love it.
I've never heard that.
No, Google it.
I'm going to Google it.
Google it later.
It's a movie. Great. It's just different moments in my life. It's been a record that's always been there. And then I suppose it was, and I played it a lot when Michelle and I got together. I just love the energy of it. The guests, the final concert.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's electrifying. It reminds you of what music means. I think I designed it. Like this sort of playlist for Michelle for our first kid being born. And that album was a big part of the playlist, you know, in order to calm her down. Beautiful. And, you know, just remember saying, turn that fucking shit off right now.
Yeah.
It's always a funny one when the men make the playlist for the birth. Hey, this is what we're going with. Okay.
You know, it never goes down like that, does it? Birth. It's never
No one needs.
Can you turn this off?
Yeah. I remember we talked water births and all sorts of things and none of that happened.
Oh, the plan.
The bath was there.
The plan.
The bath was there.
I mean, we paid for this stupid one of these birth classes, you know, where you sit around and like kids, chairs and with other couples and talk and it's like, oh, just seriously, just a waste of money and rubbish. And they said, oh, you need your birthing plan, get your music ready and then, you know, and then have your candles that you like. And they do this for a living. There is not a hospital in the country that you can take candles into a hospital room because they've got oxygen there and the fucking joint will blow up.
But when Mia was born, I'd taken my shoes off and had socks on. And the hospital floor was really polished, shiny tiles. They said, grab the leg quick and just hold. And they've said, push. And I've got socks on.
To Nick.
And I can't get grip on the floor. I can't stand and hold her leg. So I'm running on the spot. And she's going,
you've got socks on.
Standing
on. You're doing the running man.
And I pulled her pillow out from under her head. She's giving birth as I'm falling to the floor.
Just can someone get this klutz out of here? And the Benny Hill music played.
Quickly became all about me. Yeah. Going to the deck. Yeah. You know, I'm a hip, me knee. You. Fuck, I'm down. What do I do now?
There's a reason they get us out of there, you fucking know, like ridiculous. In the old days. I think there's been a shift where, you know, women go, look, the best people to be in any sort of, because, you know, really traditionally,
yeah,
you know, we always thought it was a sexist thing that men couldn't be bothered. They're outside smoking or whatever. They didn't want to know anything about it. All those jokes about, I don't want to watch it happen. Yeah. You know, it's like watching your favorite pub burn down, all that sort of stuff.
I still laugh at that one.
That's amazing.
So old school.
We are not laughing. We are not laughing at that.
Oh, it's good.
The reality is that women, you know, they
don't want to sit there.
They're doulas and they have a whole bunch of people. Way. That female energy works. Yeah. We are literally useless. And, you know, and so we, I think we like to be there and support to see the magic of it. But are we any use? No. I mean, not many of us are. I mean, I have heard of men that have been useful in that situation. But I wasn't one of them.
There's shows about them. Yeah. No, totally.
Yeah, I was fucking hopeless. Death row meal. What are you having on death row? What's your last meal?
Lasagna.
Really? Yeah, nice. That's a good option. What's your favorite cuss word? I'm going to say cuss word, swear word. James Lipton would do that at the end of the actor's studio, and I loved it when he asked actors or directors or producers, what's your favorite swear word?
Yeah. I reckon my favorite swear phrase is bunch of cunts.
Bunch of cunts.
Nice. You said it so well.
Dude, well, there's so something well. About the phonetic sound of that word. I'd say it again and think, oh,
because I just pictured it.
That's still the word.
You think about it. If I was to say to you, this is why the brilliance of it is, if I was to say to you, how is the best way for you to describe a selection of used car dealers?
Yeah.
It's a bunch of cunts, clearly.
But is there any word that captures the...
No, you got to be careful with it.
I mean, comedy-wise, did you find that? Like when you're doing shows, I mean, obviously not now, but like back in the day, you wouldn't just sort of throw that out?
Oh, I quite like pushing it out there at times. But then, you know, I'd see someone like, you know, Judith Lucy who would just swear so well.
Yeah, she would,
And use it so perfectly. I would undoubtedly not use it today in most environments, apart from when I'm, you know, with my mates or whatever, or describing a bunch of liberal politicians. Yeah, car salesmen as well.
But
I think it's all like those, like someone saying someone's an A-grade fuckwit, you know, like it's just, there's a real magic to that.
Yeah.
You know.
It's perfect.
Just what an A-grade fuckwit.
It's funny. I just pictured a whole bunch of people when you said that.
Yeah, A grade. Yeah, because we all know
straight away.
You just go, "Oh, he's a fucking A grade fuckwit." You know, it's like describing people as medium pacers. It's just such a sledge.
You're a medium pacer.
Yeah, celebrities. You talked earlier about interviews. Who's the big dogs? Who's your favorite?
I want him to be. I want to be friends with him forever and hang out.
I remember interviewing David Attenborough and saying, "I want you to be my pa." I was really blown away by him because I can't believe, you know, when I was a kid, I remember them playing Life on Earth when we were at school, you know, they're rolling the telly on the trolley and, you know, sitting there and watching this incredible documentary. And I said, I can't believe that guy is in front of me now, you know, from OU. And he was really gracious about it, you know, and, you know, he appeared to care, but he was just such a presence.
You felt gravitas behind him. Yeah.
And then I interviewed Jodie Foster before the sort of rise of sort of where what the big change happened was when the internet sort of exploded. And so, but people used to come out to Australia and they used to be a little less guarded. And it was the sort of place you could escape. You know, there's a history of people coming here and being able to do stuff. Like Elton John spent a lot of time here. David Bowie spent a lot of time here because they could just get away with things. And not that they were up to no good, but it was just they tend not to get harassed by the press. And so it felt a million miles away. And so Jodie Foster did a movie called Panic Room.
Yeah, David Fincher one, yeah.
She was really, really candid and very thoughtful. And I was really surprised by her honesty. And I don't think we would have, 2 years later, I don't think we would have done that. I mean, she's a superstar and I found her particularly gracious and so I got this mate, right, and his son is a pop star, Rule. I don't know whether you know anything about Rule, but you know, he's like a good-looking young singer. Mm. So I was at Laneway Festival with a couple of mates of a similar vintage to me, and it was pretty funny because it was like all these kids around, you know, I went for a piss at one stage and these kids turned around to my mate, Stephen Brody, and asked whether we were undercover cops. And
what are you doing here?
Yeah, and then I went to the dunny and I was having a piss and I felt like, you know, when you're on a school camp and you'd have to have a piss next to the geography teacher.
Oh, like, yeah. I felt like
I'm the fucking geography teacher.
There you go.
Yeah. Awesome. And so we're standing there on this sort of platform section. Maybe it was a VIP type section or whatever. I can't remember. But anyway, the rule is like, you know, for young girls, it's like, you know, he's a teen idol.
Yeah.
And I spotted him walking through the crowd toward, he was walking past the platform I was on. And I didn't really think about it. And I went, "Hey, Rule, how are you? You know, like, I'm your dad's mate." And he goes, "Hey, you're also." And then, like, all these girls turn around and, like, just launch himself soon. And he has to run off in a fucking frenzy because he's getting chased like he's Alvin Purple.
No way.
That's so awesome. And you remember the days, mate, you know? Early 2000s, late 90s.
I didn't get any of that cake, mate. None of that.
You rarely see that these days because of the, you know, the clips are gone and it's sort of like, if you think about it, I mean, hey, we don't know what the kids are listening to or they're listening to Rule, but that kind of sort of hero worship, you know, but when there was only sort of one, because it seems to me that everything's so flooded everywhere. You wondered if it was that same sort of Beatles intensity where you got them for a video clip and that's all. And so if you did see them in public, it would be crazy. But you're sort of saying that it's still there.
They're still there. I mean, it's just splintered because there'll be some, you know, K-pop star that everyone likes as well. And then there'll be some other star. And, you know, I love that where you get, you know, someone from, there'll be some, you know, really famous Sri Lankan singer that'll come out and all the Sri Lankan community will go and see this guy at a 2,000-seat theatre somewhere because, you know, there's enough Sri Lankans that love his music and you wouldn't even know, but, you know, can tour the country and make a fortune. So that, and social media will do that. And so there's those wonderful niches that mean that entertainers can, you know, when you're allowed to, can make a reasonable money.
Yeah, totally. You
know, anywhere in the world.
So, mate, when's the book come out? When can we expect to get us, and how do we get a copy? Is it?
Mid-November from my website, Modernista Books.
Mm. Yeah. Nice. All right.
Those books it's beautifully laid out too, man. Like when Ben was talking to me about that, looking through some of those books, the coffee table book is just like I'd like to see it sort of come back in a big way. You know, I think a lot of people now, I'm going to houses and seeing books like, you know, your books sort of stacking everywhere as opposed to sort of books about, you know, cricketers' biographies, which is nice to see. You know, the biography of Mark Taylor and Steve Waugh and, you know, it's nice to see architects.
Easy on the big dogs, mate.
Yeah, sorry, man.
Whoops. Easy on Mark Taylor. Love that.
Have you got?
Tell a story, Mark Taylor.
Yeah, I'm joking.
Do you want to talk about cricket again, mate?
Yeah, sorry, he's going back to cricket.
Jeff Leppard and cricket.
Yeah, he defaults to cricket every time.
Every time,
far out.
What could have been? What could have been, mate?
I will say though, Streets of Our Town, I will say this about my mum. My mum died 3 years ago and her favourite TV show was Streets of Our Town because you told this story about how families don't park in the driveway and walk into their home through a front door anymore. They go into a garage and they just disappear into their homes. And she loved that. She didn't know you was a comedian at all. She knew you were my friend. So beautiful, eh? You know,
she's a very special woman.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, you met mum. She's, you know.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And she told me that story. And I think those things are really important, you know. And I think the work that you're doing now is still making us laugh, telling stories, but also going into shit that was very important in the past that still needs to be important in the future, you know. And the work with the Serious Home and preserving things that are just stunning, you know, that maybe.
Yeah, we got to look after our stories. We've got to look after our heritage. We've got to, you know, remember that as a nation we can do better and we can, the past gives us a window into what we can be. And when we, you know, I think there's been times in the past where we've been much better. We've been a much better country. We're kinder to people. I listened to Bob Hawke recently on an old podcast and, you know, Bob was so compassionate, so thoughtful, and this idea of consensus that he wanted to bring everyone together. And it's to hear that now in today's environment.
Oh, man. We would say.
You go, imagine if someone said, look, you know what, we're actually, you know, I don't want to be divisive. I don't want to play those games. You know, we bring everyone together. We're all, and I suppose it's what we need, isn't it? I think this nation needs to be. There's so many wounds that need to be healed. Everyone needs to be brought together.
Do you feel like that work you're doing with telling those stories does that?
No.
I reckon it does. I said it to you. Every time I watch one of your shows, I always say that, you know, like it's nostalgic for me.
in a sense that it makes you.
Sorry, I'm not devaluing my own art. Needs more than my TV shows.
No, of course. I know there's a lot of things going
on. Some national leadership that says, you know, he doesn't.
Ben actually said before you got on, he said, Tim Rosso will solve the problems.
He's got it.
Yeah, he's got it. He's got the answer, you know?
Yeah. I'll do another architecture show. That'll save the country.
No, but there's never been more sort of like means for us to be connected with all this screen talk and everything. And yet,
are we starting this episode two now? Is there where we go?
No, but to your point,
I started this, by the way.
Yeah, but to your point, we've never been more disconnected, considering we've got so many, you know, screens with which to keep, you know, in contact with each other.
It goes a bit deeper than Ford versus Holden, you know.
Totally does. Yeah,
flat Earth, which is round,
which is really, you know. Our only, which is our old-fashioned divide.
Yeah, it just used to be, didn't it? A flag, Ford versus Holden.
People used to blast people over Ford versus Holden, but, you know.
Mm. Mate, I think that's a whole other conversation. And
that's because you drive a Volvo.
And we've carved out like an hour and 20 minutes of your time in your
motorcycle
for one night only. No, that's amazing. We've talked
to you for hours and hours and hours.
I appreciate your time,
man. That's awesome, man. Thanks so much, Tim.
Good to chat, guys.
Thanks, mate.
See you, buddy.
Well, I feel better now. See ya.